Aloha, it's Tuesday, August 26th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Molokai'i is the only island without detections of the coconut rhinoceros beetle. We take a look at what measures are being considered to keep the invasive species out. The state's Department of Education is relying more and more on emergency hires to fill teaching positions. What does it mean for students? We share your feedback on plans to renew military land leases. Many are set to expire in the coming years. And we hear about a new book that traces Hawaii's history through one family's efforts to hold on to their ancestral land. Plus, we hear from a local filmmaker on the heels of a win at the first ever Waikiki Film Awards. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Coconut rhinoceros beetles are spreading throughout the islands, with the notable exception of Molokai'i. Residents there are taking up new measures to keep the pests off the island. Here to talk about a meeting taking place this morning is HPR's Mark Liddell. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, D.W.
The State Board of Agriculture today, it's talking right now as we are here discussing the matter. They're looking at a petition signed by some of the community members on Molokai'i, right? Tell us about that petition.
For sure, and correct. They are in a meeting right now. They're probably still giving testimony. I think not maybe 20 minutes ago, they started on this agenda item. So, and people were giving testimony when I started walking down here into the studio. So yeah, there's a petition by community members that's calling for a one-year interim rule that would basically, and, you know, I'm very generalizing it, but basically ban a bunch of potential host material that the coconut rhinoceros beetle could live and breed in, and ban those material from being imported onto the island. Because as you mentioned, Molokai'i is sort of the last holdout in some ways where it hasn't been detected there, and folks are really, they really want to be have like this preventative step so that it stays that way. And as far as the petition goes, just a little note, I checked right before I came down here. There are about 800 signatures about 15-20 minutes ago. There are like 180 before the weekend, so I think it's gotten really popular, and people have started to take notice. And you know, the thing about the CRB, obviously it's a big deal here. You know, it eats a lot of some of the important crops in Hawaii. So obviously it's named after the coconut. Coconut is obviously kind of a big part of
but a lot of other culture. Crops as well too, right?
Yeah. And so it's not just coconut, but also taro, banana plants, and even pineapple, I think I heard. So it can have a pretty devastating impact, and it's, you know, clearly obviously already widespread in Hawaii. And so the rule would, again, help protect Molokai'i from that. The petition is asking the State Board of Agriculture and Biosecurity to implement this rule that would implement that ban. And I talked to Kunani Nihipali, who is a community member, and he spearheaded the petition. When I spoke to him, he talked about the importance of coconut to Polynesian communities. And he said the community is taking a stand because it's been like 12 years since CRB first came to Hawaii, and, you know, it's still being allowed to spread.
We live on islands, and every island in all of Polynesia, you're taking away a part of our life, and the coconut is associated with our childbirthing as well. So there's a lot of cultural aspects to it, not just economics, and not just to beautify the hotels and landscaping. So they need to take into consideration us, the close culture, the Native Hawaiian people, and this is the last bastion on all of the islands. And you had 12 years to knock this thing out or do better than what you're doing, and it's still spreading. So the buck won't stop here on Molokai'i.
The buck's going to stop here. Give us a sense of some of the materials they're trying to ban in the petition.
Sure. So I think, you know, the obvious one is It's decaying green waste. So and that's often used for things like mulch, fertilizer. You know, there's things like wood chips. But in the petition, it also includes things like even soil and gravel, which could be included in the interim rule. So it does go really far.
Pretty expansive, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a ban, too. So some of the interim rules that have been in place for invasive species haven't gone so far. So it would be kind of a lot. And I should say, when I was talking to Kunani, he had mentioned that the CRB, or this petition, was sort of started thinking about it because of there were different instances on Lanai where CRB was found recently. And that's also, I guess, prior to this, one of the islands that hadn't seen CRB in a while. So it's, you know, it's getting to all of the islands. It's almost like a matter of time. But that kind of spurred the urgency for folks on Molokai. And that's why we're here now. Let's see. Meanwhile, the Department of Agriculture, like I said, they're hearing it right now. The department's plant quarantine branch, they're kind of in opposition of it. They say it's unnecessarily restrictive, like we had mentioned. I was talking to plant quarantine branch manager Jonathan Ho, and he had mentioned that, you know, it could stop commerce and things like that too. And he was worried about what folks could do in the future if they just wanted to petition certain items from not coming in. So I talked to him and I asked if an overly restrictive ban could be put in place and if some of these issues can just be rolled back until like a middle ground is met.
Generally, the regulations are from infested to non-infested areas. And right, so creating like this very, very broad rule and then trying to roll it back, one, we've never done. Two, we've never restricted from areas that aren't infested to a non-infested area, because normally you don't regulate that stuff, right? You don't. And what ends up happening is, if you do that, does this open the door for the ability to try to petition the board to ban things or to use this regulatory structure for, you know, another pest potentially to start banning broad swaths of things under the intent or under the guise of trying to protect? And I'm not saying that this is what they're doing, but I think, you know, these are kind of the things that are like potentially unintended consequences with going through it, you know, I think too fast, because I don't know how quickly you can unroll it.
So taking a look at how this might sort of open Pandora's box, so to speak, but also there are practical considerations about how this can actually be carried out, right? And I think there is a move on the Big Island to try to get some limitations as well.
Yeah, so part of this reporting, you know, I decided to check up on what's going on in Kona because they found some coconut rhinoceros beetles out in Kona on the Big Island. And and so I talked with the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, and they said they found about, as of this point, they found about 80 adults and a couple of hundred larvae. So it's getting pretty bad there. And they're also hoping that the department sets up some kind of, it's not so much a ban, but sort of a compliance agreement thing where folks are sending some of these material out from or into the infested area that the businesses like check, make sure that there isn't anything there, because a human movement of material is often a big way for the CRB and other invasive species to spread. And so I was talking to Franny Brewer with the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, and she talked a little bit more about it.
If you can aggressively make sure that everything in that area is treated, you're going to ensure that that beetle does not succeed to breed. And if you can find the breeding sites that exist, if you can make sure that the food supply is not going to continue the life cycle, and you can sort of hit it from both of those sides, then yes, you can eradicate it. The further the distance becomes that these guys cover, obviously, the much higher expense that would be, the much more effort that would be, and at some point that no longer becomes possible, which is what you have on Oahu. But I don't think we're outside of that yet here on the Big Island, and so we're wanting to go as aggressively as possible.
Yeah, so there's still a possibility to eradicate it on the Big Island. And a final thought, the meeting today with the Ag Department, they're going to vote on the petition itself, so you're not going to expect a ruling. But, you know, we can tell what the board is thinking through that vote
today. Tip their hand. We'll see more to come after that. Well, we thank you for that, Mark. We've been hearing from HPR's Mark Ladau talking about the coconut rhinoceros beetle. You can learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater, presenting An Evening with Phil Rosenthal, creator of Netflix's Somebody Feed Phil, this Friday, sharing stories from his life and career. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
There's something about the way that people talk about their diets these days that has this almost evangelical quality to it. And I also think that eating protein has become something more like an identity or a lifestyle.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin September 22nd. OLLIUHM.org.
As we begin the school year, the number of teacher vacancies in the state is the lowest it's been in 5 years. To fill positions, the Department of Education has come to rely more and more on what it calls emergency hires. We heard Derek Malama just talking about this. So what is an emergency hire and what does it mean for students? Here to talk about it is Civil Beat's Megan Tagami. Hello, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is an emergency hire and how wide is this use by the Department of Education?
Right, so an emergency hire, they're essentially teachers in training. They must have their college degree, and these teachers or emergency hires must be working towards a teacher's license. So in some cases, these are teachers who have started a teacher preparation program at UH or another college and are still working towards completing this program, or they might have just one or two requirements left, like taking a licensure test. Hawaii has really seen an increase in the number of emergency hires used in public schools since the pandemic. Just for reference, in 2021, we had around 370 emergency hires, whereas last year, the 24-25 school year, we had just around 670, so around an 80% jump.
Pretty significant jump, yeah. And what are the requirements around these teachers in terms of furthering their preparation and their licensure for full credential?
Right. So these teachers who are emergency hires, they need to get their emergency hire permit renewed every year by the Teacher Standards Board. And they have essentially 3 years to complete a teacher preparation program. That means going through all of the classes, the practicums, the exams needed for licensure. The University of Hawaii has this Grow Our Own program, specifically at its UH Manoa campus, and it's meant to help cover the cost of tuition and fees for residents who are seeking their licenses. And I've talked to some emergency hires who said this program has really helped them to work towards licensure and getting all the requirements done while still being able to, you know, work full time in schools as an emergency hire.
Right. Yeah, it's important to remember that teachers are often doing their internships, their student teaching without pay. So they're kind of doing two things at once oftentimes. You mentioned the pandemic as a driving force earlier on. What's driving this increase in emergency hires now?
Right. So there's a couple of things that are possibly going on. But one thing that the teachers union really pointed to was an increase in pay for emergency hires. Prior to 2023, emergency hires were earning about $38,500 annually, but the new, teachers union contract that went into effect in 2023, it increased the emergency hire pay to around $50,300 a year. So a teachers union is saying that that has really driven up the number of emergency hires, because it is a viable way for people to earn their licenses while still being able to keep working full-time and make a living in schools.
Well, and I know that there's been some issues with some teachers coming in from the Philippines and visa issues. Is that a factor here as well?
Right. So since 2019, the Hawaii Department of Education has relied on this J-1 visa program, which basically allows teachers, international teachers, but especially teachers from the Philippines, to come to Hawaii schools and teach up to 5 years. There were some concerns last spring when ICE raided the home of several teachers from the Philippines who are living together in Maui, that, you know, around these immigration concerns that fewer teachers from the Philippines will be coming back to Hawaii schools. But at the start of the school year, the Department of Education said that they're still seeing high interest from teachers internationally who want to come to Hawaii and teach. And they hired around 100 new teachers through this visa program this year. So some principals are saying this is also a really helpful way to get teachers in schools and to fill positions, even though it's not a long-term solution. They can only be here for 5 years.
Yeah, so some bigger political dynamics at play there. You know, this word emergency, I think, can steal the headline and maybe cause some parents some concern over sort of the nature of the education the kids are getting. What do we know about emergency hires and their relationship to students and the districts in which they teach?
Right. So there was some research published last year looking at emergency hires who came into Massachusetts schools during the pandemic, and it found some interesting things. One was that the students of emergency hires tended to score lower on math and science exams, and this might be because emergency hires, they just don't have the same training and experience as their licensed counterparts. But the study also showed that these emergency hires do have higher retention rates in their schools as well. So some people are saying that, you know, this is maybe a viable way to strengthen the pipeline of teachers in Hawaii and to get people who, even if they aren't licensed to begin with, they can stay in their community, get that experience.
We really need that retention, too. That's a key thing we're looking at. Well, we thank you so much for the reporting, Megan, and appreciate you taking some time to talk to us today. Look for her stories at civilbeat.org.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our R&B, rockabilly, and early rock and roll series and feature interviews from our archive with Sam Phillips, whose Sun record label was the first to record Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Johnny Cash. And we'll feature my interview with Johnny Cash. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
We've been hearing from many of you about the military land lease renewal process, especially following our interview with Governor Josh Green last week. And we thought we'd take a moment to reflect on recent developments and share listener feedback. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll has asked the governor to work toward an agreement by the end of the year. Here's what Governor Green said when we spoke with him.
They are serious about making sure that we can still train our military in the region. And I'm serious about making sure that Hawaii is treated with great respect, that our land is preserved, that whatever process we end up with results in more land coming back to Hawaii overall, that we have remediation of some of the lands that have had deep scars put into them by the training over the decades, and that the military completely understands that we have to have a respectful two-directional relationship. So we are in the active discussion about what a future would look like, how the footprint could shrink, but we could still do what we need to for America here in Hawaii. There are several pieces of land that we hope to completely have returned to us. For example, Makua Valley, and as long as we have resources to also remediate the damage there, it's a good thing. I understand that some of the sentiment from a small number of people in general is that there should be no discussion with the federal government, but that's not practical. It's not reasonable, and it's not possible, frankly. There has to be work with the entirety of the country, and we are part of the United States, of course.
The Hawaii County Council is also set to hear a non-binding resolution next week. The resolution calls for the military to halt bombing and desecration activities at Pahukuloa Training Area. Hundreds of testifiers supported the measure in the committee hearing. Several opposed the resolution. Among them was Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce President David Kurohara. He said this at the county council meeting.
Pahukuloa Training Area is a vital part of Hawaii Island's public safety and emergency response network. Its personnel and facilities support local, state, and federal agencies in critical training and rapid response capabilities. In 2022 alone, PTA responded to over 121 emergency calls, mostly in the Saddle Road region, ranging from wildfires, vehicle incidences, search and rescues, etc. It also serves as a key training site for first responders and law enforcement, enhanced readiness across the island. It's also a critical key strategic location for the Indo-Pacific military response. PTA also plays a strong economic role for Hawaii Island, employing approximately 230 local residences and contributing $74 million annually. It invests in local infrastructure projects and draws additional spending from visiting military personnel, benefiting local contractors and businesses.
We heard from a 9-year-old and his mother on the Big Island, who called our talkback line. Here's what they had to say about Pahukuloa.
I just want to say that Hawaii is a good island, but I also want them to stop bombing our Pahukuloa because it's special to me and my kupuna, and something that's special for me is that it's also where all my kupuna would live. But if they're up there looking at what they have been doing, it makes them feel sad. So I want them to stop bombing our Pahukuloa. And that's all I want to say. Mahalo.
Aloha. O Kanoi Uluwehi Anu Hea Keis Ko'u Inoa. I am from Mokuo Ke Awe. I am the mother of Haloa Pereira, who made his call on this line. And I just want to stand in support of our keiki, stand in support of my keiki, and all of our opio who are asking the governor, the government, the military, the federal government, and our state to please stop all live fires happening on Pahukuloa, our sacred wahipana, in which our kupuna dwell, iwi kupuna. We just want to say that we support the county's resolution proposed to you folks to please listen to our plea on Moku'o Ke Awe. We do not want any more land transfers. We do not want 60-day expedition of this discussion to extend the lease sooner than 2029. And we are against all leases by the military at this time. It's been enough already. I think you folks have practiced enough bombing here in Hawaii on all of our islands, and we stand as one. Oahu, Hawaii Island, our keiki, our kupuna, many who have passed away, we stand with them all. And just like my son said, if they can see, and we know they can see that what's going on still, they are sad. And we don't want that because the generational wounds that we continue to experience are traumatizing. And we do not want that for our keiki. We do not want that for ourselves anymore. So mahalo. Please listen to our plea.
Brenda Chung from Hilo also chimed in about the lease renewal process at Pahukuloa. She writes, "Where is due process and the respect for the right of public input? The governor needs to stop these behind-closed-door meetings to cut a deal with the army now that subverts the very basis of democracy. And Elizabeth Collins from South Kona shared her thoughts with us in a voicemail.
My name is Elizabeth Collins. I'm a resident and mother that lives in South Kona in Kalia area. I would like to express deep opposition to any further military occupation of Puhakuloa. The community has spoken very clearly and expressed very strong opposition to any more occupation and bombing at Puhakuloa that definitely affects the community that resides below the mountain that's above all of, basically all of everyone's homes that live on Big Island. It is really sad that the government continues to ignore the community that is speaking very clearly. Malama Aina is a big part of the culture here, and Josh Green knows that, and he's ignoring every bit of clear speaking that the community, the Lahui, has made. There are kupuna and our Lahui that have been going to meetings and trying to communicate with the military on why it is not safe for them to occupy up there and bomb up there. Please listen to the people.
Longtime activist Jim Albertini left us this voicemail from Curtistown on the Big Island.
Governor Green, please listen to the people. Speak up to stop bombing Puhakuloa. Stop the military desecration of cultural and historic sites. Stop the military polluting the air, land, and water with deadly military toxins. No new military leases. No land swaps. No fast-tracking deals with the army. Make the military clean up its toxic mess and return the stolen lands to the Kanaka Maoli. Mahalo, Governor. Aloha.
And Rocky Kalani shared his perspective on our talkback line.
130 years of USA occupation. It's not healthy for us, for my people. I am Hawaiian. I don't want any U.S. anything here. Get out.
And we close with a listener on Oahu who had this message for the governor.
Aloha, my name is Kalani Garcia. I am on the island of Oahu, and I am calling in regard to this message for Governor Green to listen to the people and stop bombing Puhakuloa. The people have spoken. There has been resistance, and we have showed over and over the issues that we are fighting. And the military has continued to bomb our aina. It has started with Kaho'olawe, and it has continued. This is desecration. And as you know, from an indigenous perspective, the aina is alive. The people have spoken, and we ask you to please listen.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts. If you have a perspective to add to the conversation, we want to hear from you. Call our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. For 175 years, Sarah Kehalani Gu's family cared for 990 acres on Maui. It was land that was gifted to them by King Kamehameha III as part of the Great Mahele, which recast the idea of land ownership in the islands. But in 2019, Gu's family was confronted with a shock, a 500% increase on the property tax for the 90 acres that are still in the family's possession. That forced the family to confront the question, to sell or not to sell? Gu's new book, Kuleana, harnesses her family's story to explore some of the bigger issues facing present-day Hawaii, including access to land and how the experience of being Hawaiian is defined. We talked to Gu about her reporting for the book and revisiting her family's past.
This book takes place in Hana, Maui, where my grandmother was born, and many family members before that. This land has been in my family for more than 175 years and was given to my ancestor from King Kamehameha III as part of the Mihele. And the quick sketch is that in 2019, a family crisis ensued when we got a property tax bill that had gone up more than 500% without really much of an explanation. It was as if the bill really just arrived with an extra zero at the end. And we were left to really decide, you know, what to do, to pay or to sell, to fight for our lands or to give them up. And really, it actually was an easy answer. We knew that we might have to face this kind of thing someday, and this was the moment.
One thing that stood out to me in the book was when your father first showed you the land and this journey you took to sort of the inner reaches of the land. Talk about that experience there and where the two of you went.
Yes. So I didn't grow up in Hawaii. I grew up in Southern California, and I first encountered this land as a child. I was about 8 years old, and we hiked through the land. It's, you know, was wild rainforest jungle. It was a hala forest. I'd never seen trees like this before. It looked to me like upside down trees, you know, with the broomstick kind of root-like bottoms sticking up. Lots of mosquitoes kind of attacking me from all over. And it was as if we were pushing away these, you know, green leaves everywhere we went. And we hiked through a very narrow trail and made our way to what I learned was an enormous heiau. And what I later learned was really actually the largest heiau of all of Hawaii, the Pi'ilani Hale Heiau. And it was so huge, I really couldn't see how far it extended into the jungle. All I knew and was told at that time was that it was part of our family's kuleana to take care of, to protect, and that it was part of these sacred family lands that our family had also received from the king. And hearing these stories and seeing this mysterious structure really captivated my attention, my curiosity for so many years afterwards. I really wanted to know the story of this temple, the story of the land, how we got it, and why our family got it. Why us? I felt like I didn't get a lot of satisfactory answers just from family stories. And I also didn't get a lot of satisfactory answers from any books that I could find. So why was that? Why weren't there any books that told the stories of people that I was from? I think that also planted the seed for me to become a journalist, because I also knew there was something wrong with not having answers about the people I was from when there were so many other history books about people from other places of the world that seemed important enough to write down. And so I thought the Hawaiian people deserved a history book of their own. And so in a way, I feel like that's what I've written.
I love, too, that you gave some great details there in terms of the visceral experience you had approaching that land. I mean, we can talk about it in intellectual terms, historic terms, but I, too, am a child of Southern California, so I can attest to the fact that there aren't many mosquitoes. There aren't many such fecund places. It's all so planned out in Southern California. And here you were immersed in really raw land and had a response to that, too, in visceral terms. I think that that accompanied the sort of intellectual experience. I think that's important, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd never been in an environment like this before where it felt like, I don't know how else to explain it, like the jungle had really sucked me in, and I felt like so far away from civilization that it felt scary, spooky, like I wasn't sure I'd ever find my way back, not sure if I was supposed to be there, not sure if we were supposed to tell anyone that we had made it there, not sure if I was supposed to share what I had seen. And my Uncle Take, my great uncle who spent his whole life in Hana, and I think spent his whole life really protecting almost more than anyone else in our family, this temple, really told us, you know, we don't talk about it. Kuli is what he said. I remember his words. And you don't take the rocks. There was a lot of superstition, and I think there still is around. And I think there was almost just, in a way, the family secrets about the temple are also, including its location, are also what I think part of what protected it all those years. Because we know now that many heiau were destroyed, and that's more of the common story. So in a way, that is perhaps the family secrets may have allowed it to exist today. And it has been carbon dated to the 16th century. So its survival is also quite a testament to, you know, my family's kuleana.
How does the fact that you didn't grow up in Hawaii, that you grew up in California, that you've lived other places, that sort of distance that you've had so much of your life, how has that informed your relationship to the land?
Well, I think the story that I wrote in this book was really about wrestling with my rightful place, actually, my rightful ability to claim my Hawaiian identity, to be honest, because I have been always felt in between. I have always felt in my heart Hawaiian, and I have always felt when I step on the Hawaiian Islands that it's part of my soul. The language feels so natural to me, even if it's something that I didn't grow up speaking. The culture feels so natural to me. Hula feels also so natural to me. And my grandma raised us with a lot of elements of the Hawaiian culture, even in Southern California. But I think you know that in Hawaii, there is a pecking order in society here. There's also a distance in the diaspora. And I think I wrestle with the reality just of raising my own children 5,000 miles away in Washington, D.C. How can that even be possible to have my own Hawaiian identity so far away and raise my children with that connection? I did eventually come around to finding that connection through halau, if you can believe that, and to be able to find my own intention and practice. And I think that is one of the beautiful things and one of the honest conversations that the diaspora needs to have. And that's one of the messages of my book, is that it is possible. And I think that we need to actually get over this who's in, who's out kind of conversation and separation. And that my message in this book is actually, you are Hawaiian enough.
You touched on something earlier, and that is the issue of taxes. And I know taxes don't usually make for a good narrative or a satisfying narrative, but it's so important to the story because it's a story about Hawaii and land ownership in the islands. But I really do think that a lot of communities across the country, particularly in gentrifying neighborhoods, can relate to this. I know that I've spoken to families in Brooklyn, New York, that have all of their family wealth tied up in a beautiful brownstone that their family worked so hard to acquire 50, 60, 70 years ago, have worked so hard to maintain for generations, and all of their wealth is there, but yet it cannot be retained because the taxes become unbearable. Mm-hmm. And as you talk about what can we do about this diaspora to help create ways for it to come back, I feel like while taxes are a boring subject to talk about, it feels like it's a place in, right? It's a place in, and we have to find these things that are political answers, cultural answers that are real and concrete that might be helpful.
Yeah. Yes. And in my family's case, you know, I think what has been key, and I'm not saying that we've got it figured out forever, you know, it's complicated whenever you're dealing with a situation with multiple family members and multiple generations. It gets very complicated very quickly, and it can get very ugly. And for sure, the most common family situation is that these kinds of issues tear families apart rather than bring them together. But I think what's important is focusing on the value of it to your family rather than the monetary value, right? Not all things are about money. And if you can focus on some things you inherit, obviously, you can't put a price on. The inheritance is not about what you can divide up and count with dollars. And so once you focus on that shared value as a family, then the rest should not matter.
See, and this is where I think there's this gap between kuleana and a broader sense of responsibility in the U.S., because we often define responsibility in individualistic terms. You know, pull yourself by your bootstraps, take care of yourself. But you're talking that the word that stood out to me was shared.
Exactly. And that's why I gave this book the title, because I felt like this word is incredible and it does transcend culture. I do feel like it's a word Hawaiian people can teach the world. And we live in this day-to-day sense of responsibility in our work life, our busy personal lives, that if we it can really quickly take up all of our time and energy. And we can fill our days with to-do lists of the other kind of Western responsibility, and we can quickly lose track of what actually matters. And I really had to take this journey. It symbolizes the journey I had to take from that focus on the Western responsibility to Kuleana.
You mentioned that you want people who come to visit Hawaii to encounter the book, to read it, to have it inform their experience coming here. But say a little bit more about people who call the islands home. What do you want them to receive when they read this book?
Thank you for that question. Yes, I really wanted to start a dialogue, you know, for the Hawaiian people and those who all love Hawaii too, about the reality of those of us who love Hawaii and live here and those of us who have had to move away or, you know, have had family decide to move away, like my family. I think I hear a lot of, you know, Kanaka come home and move back, but I don't know that that's truly realistic. And I as uncomfortable as that is. And so we have to talk about how do we keep that Hawaiian culture alive? How do we keep that connection alive in other ways, in more intentional ways? For me, as part of this journey, joining Ahalau was one of those ways. And I think there's actually a good story in all of that. I think I see a lot of inspiration in the revival of Olelo Hawaii, for example. I was just in Seattle and met with so many people who are so active in outrigger canoe community. You know, I have an auntie in California who's Kumu Lehulu. So there's so many parts of our culture that I see being revived with intention, with a lot of practice, and generationally are being passed down. And that's really beautiful. We also talked about a little bit about ways that we can break down that stigma, right, between who is Hawaiian, who isn't, what color is your skin, how much do you know, how much were you brought up, where you go to high school, you know, all these things that I think are silly and superficial, I'd love for us to get past. But we first have to kind of bring up the uncomfortable things and talk about it and say the thing out loud. So I'm hoping that this book can provide an opening for that. And maybe it takes someone from the continent who grew up on the continent to start that.
That was Sarah Kehalani Gu talking about her new book, Kuleana, A Story of Family, Land, Legacy, and Old Hawaii. Gu will be speaking at the 2025 Native Hawaiian Convention in Washington State in October. Look for links on our website later today. Artists and moviegoers celebrated the inaugural Waikiki Film Awards this past Saturday at the Outrigger Beachcomber Hotel. It was a night of spotlighting Hawaiian storytelling and filmmaking with red carpet appearances and performances by the likes of Paula Funga and Keakena Scanlon. Kiara Lacey was among the winning filmmakers. Her 2024 movie, The Queen's Flower, was screened as part of the festivities, and she talked to us about what the celebration meant to her.
It was phenomenal. I gotta be honest. I had such an incredible time. They had live Tahitian dance. There was Kaikana Scanlon's like performing, Paula Funga performing. And of course, this incredible opportunity to have work by Native Hawaiian filmmakers celebrated, myself included, alongside Paula Funga. It was really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. The Queen's Flower, that was your film that was celebrated. Tell our listeners who might not be familiar with the film what it is.
The Queen's Flower is an animated short film for families based on a real story. So it's a magical take on a real story that was told to producer Connie Saucedo Trejo. And she had learned it from her hula teacher. One day she was at hula under Kumu Malia Herela, and Kumu was telling them about her tutu, and the story went. The family found out that Tutu was going to school next door to where the queen was living in the sunset years of her life. So the family had to know, did you ever meet the queen? And Tutu, with a wink and a smile, said, I used to steal her flowers. Now, we don't advocate stealing from queens, particularly not the ones we love so dearly, but the story behind it was that the girls at the Priory had such a special relationship with Queen Liliuokalani that she would come over, she would listen to them perform, help critique their music. And when a queen comes to your home or your school, you want to give them a lei. And there were no flowers to make lei on the property at the school then. So the girls used to sneak into the queen's incredible and beautiful gardens, pick some of her flowers and sew her a lei. And so that little family anecdote launched us on a little beautiful journey to create a film for our community.
You know, I'm curious because that's an animated film. I know you've done narrative films before as well. You've done documentaries. Is this sort of part of your body of work in terms of exploring different mediums to work in? Or do you feel like one is sort of more of a homing beacon for you?
Ooh, this is a fun question. When we started the journey of making The Queen's Flowers, we thought we were going to make a live action film. And COVID hit. And we sat down and we thought, how are we going to make a film featuring young girls and elderly women and feel safe about it? And this crazy idea to transition the film into animation popped up. And we'd never done it before and had no idea what we're doing. And would I do it again? Absolutely. It is an incredible, super fun process, so different from documentary. With documentary, you are taking things that exist in the real world and creating something out of it. With this, nothing exists. You don't even need gravity.
It's a great reminder of the vulnerability of filmmaking. I mean, you can have a storyboard, a script, whatever you want in terms of a plan for how you're going to approach a project. But there are these forces out in the world, whether it's a global pandemic or collaborators. Filmmaking takes so many people, right? All these variables that you're made to deal with as you launch into a project.
A lot of the people I work with, particularly on the documentary side, I work with a fellow filmmaker, his name's Chapin Hall. And we always talk about if you make the film that you intended from the start, you know, and it's exactly what you planned, sometimes that's a beautiful thing, but sometimes you miss the gems that you could get along the way. And so if you're really listening to what's offered to you, sometimes those little gems along the way make the film even better. And that's the goal. If you are looking and listening as you go, you're going to make something a little bit different, but hopefully it's the better version.
Yeah. And I think sometimes you have to let go of that original idea, right? Sometimes it's just a spark that initiated something and then it becomes entirely something new.
Totally, totally. And sometimes I have to remind myself, you can be a little pickier and you can be a little more precious because I'm just ready to be like, okay, what's out there, right? Let's play. But I think being open to what's available to you and really looking and listening, that also just, I don't know, there's something that's really fun about that part of the process. So I always kind of want to keep that close to myself and how I'd like to do things.
There's been a lot of talk in Hawaii about how we can better support filmmakers in the film industry, especially with high profile projects like The Chief of War, which showcases so much homegrown talent on and off the camera. And the awards program just this past weekend was also about showcasing talent in the islands. Talk about why a robust filmmaking community in Hawaii is important to an artist like yourself.
What's really important about supporting our local filmmaking community and why I have to thank the Hawaii Film Alliance and Outrigger Hotels, you know, for this event is the reminder that these are jobs. The filmmaking industry in Hawaii, this is actual jobs. People make their livelihoods on it. And there are multiple layers of benefit that we can get from having a really strong, both independent and studio level filmmaking ecosystem here. But supporting the filmmaking ecosystem here, both on the independent and studio side, not only helps keep working families in Hawaii sustainable, but it also is an incredible commercial for our home. You have a series that shoots in Hawaii. You don't need to pay for the commercial. The series itself is the commercial. People want to come down and see that scene, that place that they saw shot in Magnum PI. They want to see that place that they saw shot in NCIS. And so there are so many layers of benefit that our community can take away from having these stories to having filmmaking supported for our home.
That's a great point. And it reminds me of a conversation we had with a former head of the Hawaii Tourism Authority from years ago, talking about how they were trying to do this early on, interface with films and television production, understanding exposure.
Well, and the beautiful thing about supporting an independent ecosystem of filmmaking here is not only that we're bolstering the work that's offered in our community, but also the voice and the perspective comes from here. We can have agency and identity that is from our perspective.
Making a film is no small undertaking, as you know. It involves lots of collaboration, equipment, resources. How would you advise someone who's interested in exploring the possibility of doing this, but daunted by all those complexities? What was your start? And what would you say to someone who's interested in getting to where you're at?
Oh, man. You know, it was really fun over the weekend. Paula Funga had some beautiful things to say, having just finished her first film, Kukini. And she's such a celebrated artist on so many levels. She's a musician and a book writer. And I think some of it is Makahana Kaike is what I heard her saying, just go out and do it. You know, we learn by doing. And so this idea of fearlessness, of just going out and trying. I've seen films go to Sundance many years ago, Tangerine, and I can't remember what year Tangerine came out, but that film went to Sundance, did very well, and that was shot on an iPhone. The opportunities are endless, and it's really about what's the idea, how do we create the best idea, and then find the way to make it happen.
Yeah, I really like the example of Tangerine because that underscores the fact that filmmaking can be defined in so many different ways, and what a film is can be defined in so many ways, and one shouldn't be bogged down in making it look like something that you expect a film be whatever you want it to be.
Well, and the cool thing, if we're going to reference Tangerine, is that was an independent film shot on an iPhone that went to Sundance, and Sean Baker, who was the director behind that film, I don't know, just won an Oscar this year. So these are incredible talents using a variety of tools.
Well, before we leave you, give us a teaser on what's on your mind now. What are you working on these days?
I am working on a variety of things. I have a feature documentary being supported by PBS and a variety of other incredible institutions called Lucky We Live Hawaii. It chronicles the experience of Hawaiians and their connection to Aina or land and the history that influences it. It's a project we really believe in and is being co-created with Kristen Marquez, a fellow Native Hawaiian filmmaker out of California. And I'm doing some other fun stuff. I'm one of 8 directors on a local film called Makawalu. So 8 Native Hawaiian directors, and this is being supported by the Hawaii International Film Festival. And then something a little fun, I'm writing a little sitcom pilot called Pet Psychic.
Pet Psychic, that's a fun teaser. We can be left to imagine what we'll get there.
Totally.
Well, really appreciate you talking with us today, and congratulations on this past weekend, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
That was Kiara Lacey talking about the first ever Waikiki Film Awards and the importance of nurturing a robust filmmaking industry in Hawaii. And for the record, Outrigger Hospitality Group is an underwriter of HPR. That wraps it up for today. Tomorrow we learn about a new initiative on Hawaii Island to help homeowners reduce their energy burden, what you can do to lower your electricity bills. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm D.W. Gibson. Let's do it again. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.